Ismail Baghaei also slammed inaction of the UN Security Council in the face of Israeli violations against the sovereignty and territorial integrity of regional countries, including Syria and Lebanon. Earlier, Hamas resistance movement and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, as well as Qatar, separately condemned the raid on the Syrian town of Beit Jin. The Syrian civilians injured in Israeli forces attack in the village of Beit Jin were transferred to Damascus for treatment. Listen to some of them describe the situation they witnessed there.
Israeli forces attempted to detain men from the village, but residents resisted and clashes erupted. The troops pulled back, but returned with airstrikes and heavy shelling. They bombed several homes and the mosque. Some lost their lives and others got injured.
At 3 in the morning, Israeli forces stormed our village, trying to seize one of the young men. We resisted, and there were dead and wounded. At 6 a.m., after they withdrew from Beit Jin, we moved toward a damaged vehicle, and they opened fire on us. Then came the airstrikes, planes, artillery, rockets. I was hit by artillery fire and got injured. This wasn't the first time. 4 or 5 months ago, they took 7 men from our village. So now, whenever they come, we resist. After pulling back, they returned with planes and rockets, striking the village. They attacked from the air with heavy machine guns, helicopters, drones, mortars, raining fire on us.
We opened fire at the Israeli patrol to defend ourselves and prevent them from arresting us. My brother was martyred, and I got injured.
The hospital has received 16 wounded. 5 members of one family arrived dead. Earlier, 11 injured were brought in, among them a woman who did not survive. 2 patients remain in critical condition and are now in operation room.
And we were earlier joined by journalist Robert Fantina. They said Israeli violations against regional countries, including Syria, are part of a plot to occupy more territory amid international silence.
What we continue to see Israel doing is trying to expand its own territory in violation of international law, certainly, which says that territory can't be gained through conquest. So we're seeing this country, the Zionist regime, which is always saying it's the victim, bombing yet another country, bombing and killing innocent people, innocent men, women, and children. Several children were killed in this. Homes were bombed. What is the strategic reason for bombing homes, private residences? There isn't any. It's simply the fact that the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime, wants to clear out anybody who is living in territory that it wants. The fact that this is yet another instance of Israeli violation of international law is just appalling. When is the world government, is the world community going to say this is enough? This must stop. We see what's happening in Lebanon and in Palestine, both in Gaza and the West Bank. Now Syria, this is a rogue nation that is completely out of control and it needs to be reined in.
As well, the Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem has condemned Israel for the assassination of Haitham Ali Tabtabai, vowing resistance will retaliate.
The expression and the stance which I am announcing against the martyrdom of the Mahdi Sayyid Abu Ali, may God bless him and his comrades, this is a blatant aggression and a clear crime, and it is our right to respond, and we will determine the time for this.
Speaking at a memorial ceremony for late Commander Sheikh Qassem, said that regional and American intelligence services provide the Israeli regime with information which allows it to operate comfortably in Lebanese territory. He said ceasefire is a victory for the resistance, adding Israel failed to eliminate the resistance and was instead forced into an agreement. Naim Qassem stressed Lebanese state is responsible to ensure Israel's withdrawal and deploy the army to the south. Hezbollah's leader said that resistance weapons liberated Lebanon after decades of occupation and remain the only deterrence against Israel's expansionism. He said that U.S. and Israel are trying to strip Lebanon of its defensive capability, indicating real threat lies in Israeli expansionism and not Hezbollah's arms. Islamic resistance movement Hamas has strongly condemned Israel for demolishing 24 homes in the Jenin refugee camp, calling it a war crime. Hamas says move marks a dangerous escalation and has accused Israel of pursuing ethnic cleansing, aiming to destroy the camp, displace its residents, and change demographic reality of the occupied West Bank. Hamas urged Arab states, United Nations, and the international community to take responsibility, impose sanctions, and act immediately to protect Palestinians in the West Bank, Al-Quds, and Gaza, who it says face systematic genocide. The Israeli army on Friday demolished 24 buildings in Jenin. Hundreds of homes have already been demolished this year in Jenin, Tukaram, and Nur Shams. And joining us earlier for more on the story with your update, our Ramallah correspondent, Naka Ahmed.
Where since the hours of the morning, the Israeli bulldozers started demolishing 24 new homes in the province or in the surrounding area of Jenin refugee camp. Unfortunately, the Palestinians were wishing, or the families of Jenin refugee camp were wishing, that the demolishing operations has stopped inside the refugee camp, and some of them might be able to go back to their homes and to the home that they have been forcibly displaced from 10 months ago. But unfortunately, it seems that the Israeli forces have not taken it as enough to demolish almost 100% of the infrastructure of Jenin refugee camp, where the devastation over there is beyond comprehension. The demolition rate is quite intensive. So they went back today and started demolishing homes that are surrounding to Jenin refugee camp. The Israeli forces allowed the families to have 30 minutes, only 30 minutes, to go into their homes and to pick up some of their stuff and belongings from these homes, and then leave immediately under the threat, of course.
The U.S. has been escalating pressure against Venezuela in recent months under the pretext of combating drug trafficking. It's now launched airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean and deployed warships, possibly in preparation for military action. Camila Escalante reports.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui, Luis José Mercado, says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade, and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
And at the Venezuelan embassy in Tehran, diplomats and military officials from over 30 countries gathered to mark the 105th anniversary of the Bolivarian military aviation, as well as the 33rd anniversary of the November 27th civic military rebellion, which reshaped Venezuela's modern political history.
And now the The Venezuelan embassy in Tehran marking more than a century of Bolivarian military aviation, a force that Caracas describes as revolutionary, people-centered, and central to defending the nation's independence. This year's celebration also commemorates the 33rd year since the November 1992 civic military uprising, an event that Venezuelans regard as the rebirth of their modern air force and a turning point in their political history.
We mark 105 years of our Bolivarian military aviation, and since President Chavez established our defense doctrine in 1999, we remain fully prepared to protect the country. As you know, since August, the United States has issued threats, and for more than 17 weeks, their warships have stayed deployed. President Maduro has ordered military drills, and at the same time, we face pressure on many fronts.
More than 30 military attachés from foreign embassies in Tehran attended the ceremony, an expression of solidarity amid ongoing external pressures on Venezuela. During the opening remarks, the Venezuelan ambassador addressed what he called continuous threats and coercive measures from the United States, and attempts to undermine Venezuelan sovereignty under the pretext of fighting narco-trafficking. Iranian officials at the event praised Venezuela's resilience and its alignment with Tehran's own stance of strategic independence.
I can say that Iran and Venezuela's relations are strategic because of the high-level officials of Iran, I mean the president of the Venezuela and our supreme leader. They have this very high-level will to have strategic relationships. It's because of our beliefs about the resistance and resilience of against the imperialists and arrogant people and arrogant governments.
For Caracas, the 105th-year milestone is more than an anniversary. It is a message of continuity, resistance, and commitment to their national identity.
Iran and Venezuela may be oceans apart, but they are close in their shared fight against imperialism. And on this anniversary, Venezuela is also vowing to keep alive Simon Bolivar's legacy. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
Now, once seen as a loose coalition of emerging economies, BRICS now stands at the center of world tilting toward multipolarity. As U.S. influence shows signs of decline, BRICS nations are pressing forward, not only with political and economic clout, but with bold ambitions to craft a monetary system that could one day challenge the dollar's dominance. Earlier, we were joined by researcher and international affairs expert Mostafa Talipour for his take on this issue.
We're currently standing at a historical turning point in the international system. What is referred to as a multipolar world is in fact a natural response of rising powers and major emerging economics to 7 decades of concentrated Western, particularly U.S. dominance. And in this regard, BRICS has played 3 fundamental roles in this transformation. The first is shifting the global economic center of gravity toward the global south. It means that today, over 40% of the world's population and more than $32 trillion U.S. dollar in GDP are represented within BRICS countries. This means that the world's economic power is being redistributed, no longer confined to a single continent or a singular civilization like. The second part, building parallel mechanisms to Western-centric order. BRICS tries to establish a structure that are not dependent on legacy structures like the IMF or the World Bank, because those systems are designed by Western sides and they tried to expand colonialism.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
From east to west. the vast land of Iran. You're listening to IRIB English Radio.
Bazaar.
Our fast-paced lives have been made possible by advanced technologies. On a broader scale, technology has changed major sectors over the past 20 years, including healthcare, telecommunication, energy, and so much more. And knowledge-based products in particular have increased safety, speed, and efficiency in manufacturing sectors. Productions in this field have brought numerous social and economic advantages while generating billions of dollars in revenue, making them indispensable for Iran's economic growth. Hello again and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we're going to look at the activities of Iranian knowledge-based companies. We wanted to see how they help advance various industries and explore why their dedicated efforts are so important to the country. Plus, we will check out some of their contributions to the national economy as a whole. So, let's get started. We hear the phrase knowledge-based enterprise thrown around a lot these days, but some might be wondering what we mean by a knowledge-based company. Interestingly, there is no agreed-on definition because of the broad range of their activities. However, they all have one thing in common. They use intangible assets such as intellectual property and depend heavily on innovation as a competitive source. To get a clearer idea of knowledge-based enterprises, we visited one in Semnan province to understand what they do. With decades of experience, this company specializes in making various types of gas turbines, blades, and parts. All production here begins in the design room. Based on requirements, parts are designed, then a prototype is created using wax. Later, the wax models are used to create precise molds, which are then cast with metal. It produces products along the lines of exports, meaning that all production stages strictly follow national and international standards for quality and safety, making them compatible with international regulations and ready for market destinations abroad. Items manufactured here are used to make gas turbines. It supplies equipment to Iran's national gas distribution grids, which feed gas to cities, oil refineries, power plants, and other industries through pipes that stretch across the country. You might find it interesting that these advanced services and technologies were previously imported. This means there was a certain dependency on foreign companies to get such items, which created a lot of expensive complications. Knowledge-based companies such as the one we just mentioned are among the pioneers of indigenizing this technology, saving the country millions of dollars on imports. The beating heart of any knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here, new products are created after vast amounts of studies. It is where science and knowledge meet method and production. It is also the place where the quality of products is put to the test. But it's not just a single room. This company has dedicated vast amounts of space to these activities, which also house advanced lab technology and testing equipment. Generally speaking, knowledge-based companies employ specialists and university graduates that handle important tasks. These individuals are the glue or the bridge between knowledge and production. Highly skilled and expert staff is one of the main advantages of this competitive market. Like many businesses across the country, this firm has overcome many obstacles to enjoy its numerous achievements. One such challenge has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. However, it has come up with its own unique approach, which has turned this obstacle into a massive opportunity. All things considered, there are numerous investment opportunities in this production field, particularly regarding research and development of products that do not currently exist in the market. This knowledge-based company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its product list and optimize its production while improving items it already manufactures. The company we just talked about is one part of the giant puzzle that makes up the knowledge-based industry. The government has supported the shift to a knowledge-based society for decades. Yet this shift has been more apparent in recent years. Such support has paved the way for boosting innovation and scientific progress, leading to many economic advantages. In 2010, Iran passed several laws promoting and supporting these enterprises, strengthening a legal framework for the growth of the knowledge-based ecosystem. These efforts have paid off in many ways. Since 2013, knowledge-based companies and startups have grown over 140-fold to 7,000 active units today. These firms make thousands of specialized technologies that have massively reduced the country's dependency on foreign imports. Moreover, these businesses have increased developments in the production of medical devices, energy, agriculture, ICT, aircraft maintenance, mining, petrochemicals, biotechnology, and so much more. In fact, Iran also exports a lot of specialized products. According to figures from the National Innovation Fund, tech firms and knowledge-based companies raked in over $5 billion in revenues last year. In total, presently, Iran's knowledge-based ecosystem accounts for more than 3% of the country's gross domestic product. That's going off of statistics from the Vice Presidential Office for Science and Technology. So far, the government has implemented numerous policies and plans to help support knowledge-based companies over the years. These schemes include loans with low interest rates, tax exemptions, and easing commercial license issuances. The goal is to encourage the development of Iran's tech ecosystem and boost lucrative, high-tech productions for exports.
While I take a quick little break here, you go and watch this next segment. I'll be back shortly. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. I'm your host Ali Reza, and today we're checking out a knowledge-based company that is saving the country around $20 million worth of imports annually by managing to produce inhaler capsules that we use to import from foreign countries through in-house knowledge, research, and technology. Stay tuned to find out how they did it.
Patients with asthma or dyspnea need to use inhalers to get the prescribed drug into their lungs. That requires not just the active substance of the drug, but also a sort of carrier to take the drug into your lungs before it is fully absorbed in your mouth, before it even gets down your trachea. You will find them mixed with the active substance in inhaler capsules that the inhaler punctures once you put the capsule in, which then you inhale.
Our journey begins in the storage room where they bring in the raw material, the active substance for these inhaler capsules in the form of tiotropium bromide. Now, this company produces 45 million of these inhaler capsules annually for the 150 to 200,000 patients in the country that are prescribed to use them. And they use not more than 1 kilogram of this active substance, this tiotropium bromide, to make all of these.
The raw material in the form of a small amount of tiotropium bromide, as well as the excipients, which would be the aforementioned carriers that mix with the active substance, are then sent to the production line along with the gelatine capsules themselves, which would later be filled with our formulation substance, the mixture of our active substance and the excipients.
So before we get into the actual production line, first they bring the raw material from the storage room to allocate, to determine what amount of each formulation material they need to bring into the production line. So that includes the active substance, the aforementioned tiotropium bromide, and the excipients, which is the additive substances. So once they've allocated the necessary amounts of those, they bring it to the production line.
Perhaps the biggest challenge in the production line is the mixing of an infinitely small amount of active substance with the excipients to get a completely uniform mixture of our formulation substance that you would find inside the capsules. The production line would have to be sensitive enough to mix 18 micrograms of tiotropium bromide with 10 milligrams of excipients in a completely uniform way. 1 microgram, by the way, is 1/1,000,000th of a gram. Because this company has managed to fully domesticize the production technology of this particular product, they're able to save 90% of the currency that would otherwise be spent on procuring this very product for the patients in the country through imports. That is $9 million worth of savings, and they're fully capable of doing that because their production line allows for even leftover for exports. Because of the competitive pricing of the aforementioned tiotropium bromide capsules, the value of the potential exports of this product is estimated to be around $30 million.
So, what they do is they use a regular inhaler as a normal patient would. They would insert the capsule in it and use a lung simulator. So they would insert the inhaler, and with the help of a vacuum pump attached to this flow regulator attached to the simulator itself, they simulate the flow of a normal human inhale and see how much of the formula is administered to different stages of the lung. Each of these circles has holes on them, which gets exponentially smaller the lower you go, to the point that at the bottom you don't really even see any of these holes. And the residue left by the formula through inhale, we test out to see how much of the formula is left on each stage, and then we would see whether the residue left is to the measures up to the amount that we wanted it to, and that pretty much concludes the test, the performance test for our formula, and that also pretty much concludes this episode of Boaz Earth. Till next time, take care and bye bye. That covers our program for today. On behalf of the entire Bazaar team, thank you for tuning in, and it's bye for now. Until then.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the scent of the martyrs. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, welcome to A to Z here on I'm Being Shreya with Mrs. to Zainab. And look, the scent of the martyrs, I'll just give an anecdote from life of one of the famous martyrs from Home Defense, Sayyid Jan Bozorghi, just to sort of give you an explanation as to what I mean by the scent of the martyrs. Because for sure, there are different ways of interpreting this title. So the little anecdote from his life is that his wife would, for example, always say that her husband, Sayyid Jan Bozorghi, always wore a pleasant scent. And so and there are several aspects even to that. So he was very particular about just hygiene or Islamic hygiene in particular, and always having sort of very clean presentation. So she would observe that even his socks were really clean for a man, and his clothes were always fragrant. And as we're talking about a martyr, I will just add in this extra thing that, you know, might also, bring sort of feelings of sadness to many of us when we even just become aware of this, that they always say that, you know, the martyrs, can have a very special scent. And indeed, the spouses of the martyrs will sometimes say that, you know, because they understand, they feel the presence of their martyred husbands. Well, usually there are some, obviously, female martyrs too, but often it's the martyred husbands we're talking about. And they will say that they sometimes get the sense of their husbands being near their presence because of the scent. So this is something very special. But let's talk about this a bit more. Welcome back to A2Z here on I'm Being Shreya with me, Sister Zainab. And so obviously I'm talking about, hygiene, cleanliness in Islam. But in particular, this idea of, you know, the scent of the martyrs or the fragrance of the martyrs. And, you know, there was a very special little story that was told to me by the mother of one of my closest friends. And she told me that she had engaged in, you know, just a sort of sealing herself off from, you know, the outside world. I think she'd managed to do it for a week or 10 days. And things change, so people do start to observe different things. And she would then, when she started to perform her prayers, be able to smell this very beautiful fragrance. And, you know, obviously this is something that, you know, maybe some of us need to, whether some of us can actually reach to that level where we, you know, can sort of purify ourselves and focus just on our worship, or just focus on, our inner nature and purifying away some of these flaws that we have. And obviously with that, we will gain access to many other things around us, because obviously there are many other worlds, and there is obviously what is called the unseen. And for probably, I suspect, many of us, we have no idea really what that is. We do not understand. And so obviously, to finish off with, you're talking about the scent of the martyrs. Urge you and advise you to maybe read up a bit more about the martyrs and some of these experiences that especially the family or the spouses of the martyrs have had, where they do sense the presence of their spouses and they do smell the beautiful fragrance. And I think that in itself is something that helps us to purify ourselves each time we read about the martyrs, for sure. So, inshallah, these are just reminders for us, and I look forward to welcoming you to another episode of HZ here on Arab English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to India and Global Left.
Thanks for having me. Good to be back.
We have been covering U.S. escalation on Venezuela on this channel from various angles. There's been a full-blown escalation on the Caribbean from Puerto Rico, from where this so-called war on narco-terrorism has been launched. Over and above that, there are huge buildups of U.S. military assets in the Caribbean, including the coast of Venezuela, including attack operations. And it must be mentioned about the escalation of propaganda war, including the Nobel Peace Prize. And Maria Corina Machado has been promising all kinds of Venezuelan assets to U.S. corporations. Obviously, Trump has indicated that he wants a regime change. There is no doubt about it. But the question is, how far would the U.S. go to attempt that regime change? I wonder what your thoughts are about the current U.S. strategy on Venezuela.
My thoughts go back to the Bush administration that I served, George W. Bush, from 2001 to 2005. And some of the things that we did there that I'm seeing repeated, only with more profundity, more depth, more breadth, and more illegality. And I mean that in both a domestic and an international sense. Start at the very top and talk about what the Nuremberg trials, which we are now celebrating, what the 80th anniversary of, and the major decision there was encapsulated in something Justice Jackson wrote, and it went something like, the purpose is to stop wars of aggression. The whole purpose of the process, the American purpose, others sided with that purpose during the course of the tribunal, but some did, as the Soviet Union, I would say, did for reasons of expediting what they needed to get done, because like the British, who wanted to take all the war crimes home, all the war criminals home, and shoot them, the Russians wanted to take, the Soviets wanted to take them all to Moscow and try them in show trials and then shoot them. So when Jackson did that, when he ground the real purpose of the tribunals down to wars of aggression, his opinion, and I think it was right, and this was what the UN was then later built on, was that that was the kernel of all murderous war in the world, aggression. And so that's what the tribunal tried to at least leave some voices. And then later in 48, we had the first, second, third, and fourth Geneva Conventions and other attempts to make war, I won't say more palatable, but to make war at least more reasonable, if nothing else. And to have some rules and to have some laws and hopefully some very strident laws. The other thing that the tribunal did was establish the precedent of international criminal justice and international criminal law. We are now destroying that, peg by peg, thread by thread. we are unweaving, if you will, the entire fabric that began in 1945, continued in 48, and continued in the years following as we tried to develop the UN and to develop the rationale for the UN. Now we are the biggest culprit on the face of the earth for wars of aggression. We are trying to essentially conduct a war of aggression against Venezuela. We're already there with the CIA. We've been there since 2016 when Donald Trump signed a presidential finding for Mike Pompeo, then the head of the CIA, to begin a war on the ground in Afghanistan or in Venezuela. So I get tongue-tied at all the wars that we have. So you can't even say that this is new, because it began in Trump's first administration with a very violent direct action in Venezuela conducted by special operating forces and the CIA.
Is there any way to predict how far the Trump administration would go? I mean, there are speculations about Tomahawk firing. There are also talks about actual invasion. There are a lot of noise about Gerald Ford, the largest aircraft carrier, taking to the region. What is your intuition about whether the propaganda device propped up by the Trump administration, whether they would be limited to that, or they would go whole hog and take a military intervention? Given, I want to mention that scholars from Latin America are saying that this kind of escalation about U.S. intervention is even dividing the Venezuelan opposition, and a section of the opposition which were earlier supporting sanctions, thinking that that would topple Maduro's government, are now turning against U.S. escalation because they're against U.S. military intervention in their own country. So I wonder, is there a way to predict if the Trump administration would take the military course all the way?
That latter point you made, I think, is true. And let me back up and give a little bit more explication of what's happening there. I'm 90% sure of this because I have some contacts still that will talk to me. What has been going on has been a joint operation, maybe even more than a joint operation in terms of a third or a fourth party. But there are certainly two parties in this. One, of course, is the empire, the United States, but the other, very substantively, is Israel. Israel is there big time. Israel has been there since the first finding in the 2016 year of Trump's first administration. Israel is a part of the intelligence picture, whether it's false, fair, accurate, or whatever. And in most cases, I think it's pretty false. And Israel is a manipulator of the intelligence that Trump is getting. One of the people giving Trump the intelligence is an Israeli citizen, dual citizen, of course, which is what we like to have in this country. But he's an Israeli citizen. He's linked with a former CIA individual who are giving for money Laura Loomer intelligence from Venezuela that they say is accurate, and Trump is turning his face away from the vested intelligence community, starting with Tulsi Gabbard and others, and listening to Laura Loomer. So he's getting his intelligence about Trinidadagua, about drugs, and so forth, from a source that's being paid by certain members of the opposition in Venezuela to give him that intelligence. You can't make this up. Israel is a big part of that, and the person who's working with the CIA operative is an Israeli citizen, as I said. You got the Nobel Peace Prize winner, as you said, Mochado, who is plugged into it too. I won't go this far, but I will at least surmise that she might be a Mossad asset. So you have all of this going on, and then to come to your question, is any of this really going to overthrow Nicolas Maduro and the government he represents? I don't think so. And I think it's going to be a real disaster if we try to use major force, force majeure, to do it. Whether we sneak up on it or we frontally assault it, it makes no difference. We're going to get our hands tied in a mess. Think Vietnam, think Afghanistan, think any of the wars that we've been involved. Think Somalia, for example, when we went in supposedly to do humanitarian good and wound up chasing warlord Mohammed Farah Adib and had to withdraw ignominiously from Mogadishu. That's what we're looking at. And this president doesn't seem to have a grasp of this sort of thing.
It is known to almost everyone in Venezuela that while there is a debate about the sanctions when it comes to military intervention, the Lopezes and Guaidos and the Machados are all people who live in Florida or other parts of the United States and not real people living in Venezuela. And I also wanted to add that, as you indicated, that there seems to be division within the military and the intelligence, probably within the military, people who know the reality of Venezuela and those who the partisan hacks and, you know, those all the on the payrolls of Mossad and so on. I think the fact is that in Venezuela, the military is extremely politicized. And this is a distinction between, for instance, Chile in 1973, where Allende Salvador didn't go after the military to replace with his own people, which is not the case in Venezuela. So in Venezuela, the military is extremely hooked into the whole Bolivarian process, meaning thereby that any kind of attempt of coup is extremely difficult in Venezuela. And one might disbelieve numbers of millions of militias being recruited. Those 7 million, 8 million might be overstated, I don't know. But it is true that there is a popular consensus, unanimous consensus in Venezuela against U.S. military intervention.
Yes, I'm a student of the Chilean episode with Nixon and Kissinger. I can tell you it's quite different. The Chilean military was really on our side throughout all those years because we had bought them, essentially. And they knew because we had bought them, if it were a coup that was successful, they would be in charge. And so all they did was fight over who the general would be that would be in charge. A little bit different situation. Here, we have not been through the school of America, of the Americas or whatever. We have not been up close and personal with the Venezuelan military in any way other than maybe some CIA infiltration and trying to bribe people. That could have happened. I suspect it has. But I don't think they've been very successful in that effort because the military has basically been loyal. So this would be an entirely different operation. You would probably have the bulk of the military, the Venezuelan military, against you from the get-go. That's a very different situation than buying the military out and having them, even as they did in Chile, turn on Allende and produce who they produced, which was not too good for Chile. So I think what we're looking at is a true guerrilla war that we'll lose. And while I would love to see us lose in a situation like that yet again and try to teach us a lesson in terms of those kinds of things, I don't want to see that pain brought on Venezuela or on Colombia or Nigeria or anywhere else, especially not when it's not called for. They are not threats. Here's the fundamental thing. They are not threats to the national security of the United States. Trump and his Justice Department and his Defense Department leap through hoops every day with the Speaker of the House and the leader of the Senate orchestrating their leaps and being very, very supportive of them to substantiate that what they're doing is in the name of the national security of the empire, which is preposterous. Even with Iran, it's preposterous. Iran presents no threat of significance to the empire, unless the empire wants to sit in the middle of the Persian Gulf and wave a flag, which President Ahmadinejad once said to me in New York, let me see if I've got this right now. Iran owns about 1,875 kilometers of Persian Gulf coastline. And the United States owns how many kilometers? His point, very vivid point. The threat in the Persian Gulf was not from Iran. The threat was from the United States of America. And everybody in the region knew that, even the Saudis and the Emiratis and others. So there is no threat to the national security of the United States from any of these targets that Trump is looking at, with the possible exception of China. And, you know, what are we doing there? That's another issue altogether, but it's a big issue. It's a huge issue. It's a nuclear issue.
I want to actually come to China, but just a side comment on the threat. It reminded me of some of these debates in the 80s about U.S. generals saying that Nicaragua and possibly even Cuba are posing great threats to the United States. And in one of these debates, Noam Chomsky said that it would be a disservice to even Hitler, saying that his narrative that Czechoslovakia was a threat to Germany would be similar to the threat caused by Cuba or Nicaragua to the United States. I mean, even Hitler might have some point when he made a statement about Czechoslovakia. I mean, such is the absurdity of U.S. inventing threats from these small nations. But I think I wanted to discuss China, particularly maybe in the context of Latin America, given one of the reasons why Trump and his ilk, of course, the Secretary of War, who wants to keep doing war to keep his position and job. But Marco Rubio, it's just someone on steroids, just going on and on. There is a huge China factor, given the economic ties and relationships with a whole range of Latin American nations, Brazil, Venezuela, even Panama, even Mexico, which is the largest partner, economic partner of the United States. These are China, Latin American nations' economic ties are rapidly increasing. And we have been discussing, you have spoken on our show about the U.S. empire having to wrap up its empire and become a nation state again. And given the recent loss the U.S. faced against China, I mean, it was very confident when it launched its economic warfare and it had a humiliating defeat. What do you think is the grand strategy of the United States when it comes to China going forward? Is there any reset in thinking of the Stephen Miller's and you know, the Manhattan Foundation and all these China hawks? Is there any rethinking and resetting given the humiliating loss they faced recently, or are they continuing down the same path, even designing a nuclear war with China?
I can detect no strategy, none whatsoever. I detect a menagerie of people who think they have a strategy and who can express that strategy from time to time in terms that are almost indecipherable. Steve Bannon comes to mind immediately, and even Pete Hegseth. But I don't detect any grand strategy, nor do I detect a strategy vis-a-vis a bloc of countries or a single country like China. No strategy whatsoever. And back to your point about China, everywhere virtually that China is making inroads, they are doing so because we have screwed it up so badly that people are begging China to take over. That's how awful it is, particularly in the Western Hemisphere. Brazil is a perfect case. China is moving in where it detects weakness and mistakes by the empire, and they are making great headway doing that. You don't even have to quote Sun Tzu. It's not an indirect strategy. It's a strategy of, look there, my major enemy is making gross error after error after error, and I'm flowing into those errors and giving the people some alternatives. That's what's really happening. And it's a sad, sad commentary, because I don't think this administration understands that's what's happening to them. I don't think Donald Trump understands that Xi Jinping handed him his rear end in the last meeting they had in China, handed him his rear end, as in beat him to a pulp. So he comes out and announces that it was a great meeting. I'm sure Xi Jinping thought it was one of the best meetings he'd ever had. Although these people like Putin and Xi Jinping and even Modi and certainly Lula have to wonder, and I think there are a few people in Europe who might be leaders of the future replacing Starmer, Macron, and all the rest of the idiots over there who detect this too, that what I'm saying is in fact happening. And they're trying to decide, do I want to go whole hog with China? Do I want to be independent? Do I want to be 50-50? What do I want to do? Because I don't want to sell my soul to anybody, even China, but I can't depend on the empire anymore. In fact, I have to fear the empire now. That's what people are thinking around the world. And as I said, increasingly they're thinking that in NATO, not in the current governments, but in the ones that are going to replace the current governments, which, mark my words, will happen in the next 18 months. Every government will be replaced in Europe. It'll start with France, England, and Germany, but it'll roll like an avalanche over the rest of Europe as they realize 5% of GDP? Are you kidding me? Where's my social programs? Where's my agricultural programs? Where's my free education? Where's my free health care? All those sorts of things. These leaders aren't going to hang around. And that's worrisome because I wonder what Europe's going to do when it really hits. Are they going to go back to the Europe of the 30s, or are they going to form some sort of European security architecture to start with? And is it going to include Russia, for example, as we had contemplated at the end of the Cold War with George H.W. Bush? I would say that's going to be very difficult given what Russia has seen NATO do to it in the past, you know, since 2014, certainly, and even before that. I was just reading a report on the Nazis in Ukraine. Holy mackerel. I mean, they're all over the place. Putin has not just not eradicated them yet. He's pushed them all up into the remaining sector of Ukraine. And they're all around Zelensky. And Zelensky can't move without these people. He can't move. He can't do anything without them. They'll blow his brains out the moment he decides he wants to do something not in their plans. And there's quite a few of them. I always thought when I was working with Ukraine back in the early 2000s as chief of staff of the State Department, our intelligence was telling us maybe 150,000, maybe somewhere between 100 and 150,000 true Nazis. I'm talking about Bandera's boys. What I saw the other day of the list comes from our own intelligence community, and it's well over 200,000. So this is a pretty